Blog Talk Radio.
The day he gets out, he's deported from Madisonka. Turns out Maria and her child were long gone before the cops ever got to the apartment.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is We Talk Productions, one of the few black radio networks that explore solutions to issues in the black community. Presents Black Earth America. The lineup for the week is Tuesday evenings. We have Black Earth America. Wednesdays, we have Cutting Edge with Sean. Thursdays, we have Part of Harlem with Wayne A. Young. And Saturdays, we have Provocative Thought with Carlton Steele. Now, the show tonight was supposed to be about black community roles in public policy. And the person we had put scheduled for over a month and a half, scheduled for today, she was the National Co-Executive Director at Urban Leaders Fellowship. However, I'm trying to get her, and if she doesn't come on, we have to cancel the show because, we have to cancel the show because I'll have an alternative topic. Let me see if I can be in touch with her. And we'll be right back.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruption. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on Deport from 29 District. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on the rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry R. Woman Liberationist and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis.
Let's see if this is her. Oh.
Hello.
Miss Samuel?
Yes, this is me.
Okay. Hold on for 1 second. All right, Miss Sean is here. Okay, with us tonight. Well, before I bring you on the guest, just want to ask you for a thought. Are black communities protected by policies in America? Do we need policy to protect our communities? Now, join us is the National Co-Executive at Urban Leaders Fellowship, Ms. Tamara Samuel.
Hi, good evening. Thank you for having me.
Welcome to Black Urban America. Ms. Samuel, this is Ms. Sean. Ms. Sean, this is Ms. Samuel.
Hello, how are you?
Nice. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm great.
Okay. Can you explain to us what is Urban Leaders Fellowship?
Sure. So the Urban Leaders Fellowship was founded a decade ago out of Colorado Springs, Colorado. Then Senator Mike Johnson, he got into office and he realized that there weren't enough individuals who were black, indigenous, brown, from our communities that were at the front and center of local and state policy. And so he and his friend, Damian Netapali, came together and created a fellowship that would, number one, do two things: provide the best and brightest an opportunity to impact policy. Two, also get grassroots exposure to nonprofit and startup work. And so when you fast forward now to 2021, we are in 10 cities, including Atlanta, Dallas, Denver, Indianapolis, Kansas City, Missouri, Nashville, New Orleans, Tulsa, Oakland, and D.C. We have impacted more than 136 policies, from educational equity to housing and mobility, and then most recently in Oklahoma through Representative Monroe Nichols passed SB 200, which is the legislation where anyone that is a victim of domestic violence will not be evicted. We also had several, I would say, instrumental research pieces with D.C. piloting the mental health initiative, where if someone calls 911, they're not automatically going to dispatch police. They're going to look at behavior and sociology and mental health professionals to work with those individuals. So that's just in a snapshot, the urban leaders and where we are. Anyone can apply to our program. We request and ask for 2 years of professional experience because it is a dual experience between grassroots nonprofit organizations and then also serving as a policy advisor to one of our 17 local or state elected officials.
Okay, now, In your description, well, let me ask you this. Do you feel black communities are underrepresented when it comes to developing policy that affects our community? If so, why? Why are we so not representative in city, local, state, and federal levels of the government when it comes to policy making?
That's an excellent question. I think it's twofold. If we look at current statistics right now, of course, in the House, we are on parity with 13% of the black population of having that representation, right? But then when you look across the board and you go higher at state gubernatorialships, and then when we go back down to our local elections, we're underrepresented because people sleep on the local elections. And then beyond that, I think there's a huge focus on the vote, but not necessarily looking at the agenda. Also unpacking that agenda and thinking about when I vote, what am I voting for? And then how do I support what I'm voting for across party lines? Thinking about those alliances, and then most important, the dollar and building coalitions to make that happen. And so those are some of the reasons and factors, at least from where I sit, not only in this role, but having lobbying in Congress. I've worked with unions before. I've worked with the Governor Consulate of Canada, down to the Nashville mayor, even to the former City of Houston mayor, Arnice Parker, to where those things play a huge role in representation. Because not only do we got to vote, we've got to finance the individuals that have the credibility and the agenda that is going to represent us on these larger social issues to put them in those seats. But then once they're there, this is where a large part of where the urban leaders comes into play, is that you've got to impact change and progress. And we can't just do that off of smiles and giggles and charisma. You've got to actually look at language. There is a certain nuanced way, and I think we've seen this with our white counterparts. There's a nuanced way of once someone is in office, you've got to work across the aisle to ensure that things are done, and there's some strategy behind it. And we don't always, even when we're in those seats and in those places, we don't necessarily have access to put all of those specific points together. And I can raise up several examples and several stats. Even now, when we look at the New York mayoral race, we've got two contenders. Of course, Maya Wiley, she's highly endorsed by AOC. But who she's going against, Mr. Eric, is endorsed by Andrew Yang. So think about the money and the access there. And think about the agendas of these individuals and their track records. That plays a huge role.
And speaking of track records, in many local, speak of local elections, in many urban areas where these local elections are held, black folks win the elections. But however, when they get in office, why are there progress in black communities when you have a black elected official?
Absolutely. That stems on some of the other factors that I just mentioned, but I'm going to zero down on two things. The first, and this goes all the way back to the 1980s election with Jesse Jackson when he ran for president.
I remember.
There's the shifting tide, right? Number one, Theodore Johnson talks about the black vote being a monolith, and it comes in this split. And that first is that we tend to gravitate to our own. That's fine and that's good. But what happens is we miss what agenda can that person realistically push, because you got to look at all the other key players that sit in a city council. I'll use another example. If we look here in Houston, there are several rumors that depending upon the relationship of the city councilman and the mayor, certain agendas, whether it is cleaning up abandoned buildings, facilities, making sure that we're redistricting lines, where that black children have more access to the higher performing schools, whether it's a local ISD or charter or private or suburbia, that because of that relationship, thousands of dollars get blocked. So the district councilman is faced with one or two things. I know what I need to do for my community and my people, but I also stand a chance of not being reelected. Maybe I got to go along and get along. And again,
I think there's too much of that go along, get along. And I think that go along, get along, we really, as professionals and individuals, not only professionals, but as community folks, I'm really speaking to elected officials, you really got to look in the mirror and say, okay, when this go along, get along, have to stop and really look at the real issues that are affecting my people. Now, before I go on, I'll go ahead and Sean ask a question, and then we have a caller. Go ahead, Sean.
Okay. What I wanted to ask about is, Dr. Carter G. Woodson, in his book, The Miseducation of the Negro, wrote, "Blacks are the only group of people who take their most precious possessions, their children, and ask their oppressors to educate them and mold and shape their minds. Should teachers be teaching black children if they reject anti-racism?"
Do not think teachers should teach if they are rejecting anti-racism. Prior to me coming to the Urban Leaders Fellowship, I was in education for 14 years. And I saw this play out in our rural schools as well as our urban schools, you name it, the full gamut, and even at the post-secondary level. And I think it's very important in the time in which we are living and educating kids in, is they're a different generation. They're a different generation in terms of how they even identify themselves. If we think about from the LGBTQIA+, which we can argue and think about so many different things of that being an agenda to dismantle and divide the black community, that has been our downfall. And we can come back to that. But more than anything, there is this sentiment where you've got children that you are entrusted in, but you don't know what environments they come from. You don't know what environments they're coming back to. And with several of the red tape that is put on teachers, your onus is to ensure that you go in and you teach those children, meet them where they are, and give them the full holistic view of the subject or content area that you're teaching.
Well, understand this. I was going to ask about education later on in the show, but since education is right here, right now on the show, let me ask you this. Why hasn't there been any type of policies when it comes to our children in the black community as far as education? Why has policy changed in terms of adding a STEM curriculum? Every educator that come on the show, I ask them the same question. How come there have been policy to add STEM, a STEM curriculum or a STEM education with Afrocentric thought? And we have black superintendents, we have black educational commissioners, we have a lot of black principals, black teachers, black school boards with some black folks on it. Why there haven't been the policy to address the curriculum in our black schools?
Several reasons. The biggest one is that, we got to focus on the state test, whether that is SAR, whether that is...
Yeah, I heard that before. I heard, especially in the Bush years.
You were taking a region. So what happens is trickle-down effect, right? The state agencies, they are pushing for so many kids at a higher passage rate because they want to get in as many federal dollars as possible. That goes to the district SSOs, chiefs, principals, superintendents, all of that are like, all right, you know what you have to do. So that sucks the life. And here's what's interesting, too, y'all. When you look at some of the curriculum policies that are put forth by various states, a lot of it really gives districts and schools a little bit more autonomy. But what happens is one phrase or one line, or you have someone's boss's boss that comes in your school and says, you got to get ratings up. And so what happens is they focus on the standard-based curriculum, failing to identify, number one, the changing need for our kids, and number two, giving them skills to compete, which brings me to the second. Our educational system has not changed since the industrial period. When you think back and you look through books and you look at history, it hasn't changed. So guess what? And I'm a huge proponent as an educator of education. I have four children of my own, three black princes and a princess, okay? But the bottom line is in our schools today, we're teaching a lot of things that really don't equate to global skills. And if we look at what happened in the midst of the pandemic, look at several of our school districts. They either, number one, they had this expectancy that just because someone can use a cell phone or laptop that they're digitally competent, teachers and adults included. Two, we don't think about the effects in a black community that if a mom, the 66% of our mothers are leading households, and when you look at the World News report, we got 4.59 million women that are unemployed since COVID. Half of that are our sisters, right?
Right.
So they're having to make decisions between, do I pay my internet or do I pay my rent to take care of my baby? That's just a reality. And some right. are also holding their parents. They're all factors. But yet you still have a school, and I was part of it too as an administrator, that says, well, if your child doesn't log in by such and such time, they're going to get an F. Wait a minute. We realize what's happening, but yet we haven't redesigned and reshifted and engineered a education system, number one, that's equitable, two, that is transient across time, and then three, that's relevant, because we are still encouraging our black Hispanics, too, we can look at the notes, to go to college. But when you look at statistical data, we've increased by 45% enrollment. But when it comes to securing jobs across industries, STEM included, we are not increasing. It's not translating. So we have a structural issue within education. We have a curriculum issue in education. And then we also have this policy issue in education, because we're focused on teacher recruits. Yes, it's important. Across several states, we're one of them. We're short 20,000 plus teachers. That number is quadruple because folks are tired. They're
well, how about hiring some black teachers? 72% of the teachers in schools in the black community are white females. How about hiring some black teachers?
Yes.
In Milwaukee,
and let me speak to
that. There are like 10,000 black teachers unemployed in Milwaukee, for example.
Absolutely. Sorry. Go ahead. No, you're fine, because I love that you mentioned that, because it's exactly where I was going. So there's always talk about teacher recruitment. Here in Tennessee, we can also take this to Kentucky, who just got screwed out of their pension. I think everyone has read that in 2018. So you can imagine small percent of like 1.5 to 3% black teachers. They don't even know if they're going to have a pension, okay? And we can go to some other places across the country. The way that the tests are designed through Pearson, through National Board, on average, it takes our black men and women 3, 4, 5 times to pass the exam. Well, guess what Texas did 6, 7 years ago? They passed a policy that if any aspiring teacher does not pass a single content exam by the fifth time, they have to go to another content exam. And so guess what that happens? Because most of our black teachers, they fall into physical education. They are in music. They in health. You'll find a couple in English language arts, social studies, history, the full gamut. But by the time someone sits for an exam, this happened to my best friend. She doesn't even teach anymore. She had to just go to a district role because she had, quote, unquote, flunked out. So we have policies and systems that are making it much harder for our black men and women to even enter the profession. And then when we get past that, when you look at the abysmal, I mean, it was 11.5% of us that make it to administrator. How many of us say, look at the type of schools that we receive and the lack of resources there, and then you're trying to buy a cheese to make it work. And so that sucks the life as well as it sucks the opportunity for us to come in and say, you know what, I am a chemist. One of my close friends who moved down here several years ago to teach at KIPP, she was a chemist, amazing, okay? Numbers through the roof, but it took everything for her to change from a New York system to a Texas. She's a chemist. She can actually go to engineering. But it's those types of policies, and this is why we have to pay attention to who is elected on the local school board and the state DOE, so State Board of Education. They actually have more power neck and neck alongside our commissioner of education. And we saw this play out in the beginning of the pandemic because everyone's looking around like, okay, well, we knew that we should have been preparing kids for STEM and STEAM, and we should have provided them with technology, but, like, who makes the decision? Oh, we're going to defer to SBOE, and you look at the SBOE makeup. 80 to 90% of them are white. Many of them come from different sectors. That's no knock. We need finance. We need accounting. We need all of that acumen and engineering to design equitable landscape for our kids. But often than not, what happens is you have one or two of us there and very few people that can speak to the reality of what is happening in the four walls of a school. And that is why policy has been slept on with providing the STEM, the STEAM, equitable black education. I had people tear down my posters when I was teaching in Tennessee. That's where I started my career, because I was teaching children African-American lit and infusing different parts of history with it. Every black male that came in my class, I made sure they read Malcolm X. People got wind of that.
I think
that's cool.
You better be glad that you wasn't hung from a tree.
Exactly. Exactly. And I said, no, he's going to teach our kids about our history. They need to know. They need to understand some of the fights that they are up against. They need to understand that there are people who have fought and made progress for us, but guess what? There's still a lot of progress left. And I'm going to teach this in 2009. You say what you want to. You can do what you want to. It doesn't matter, because that is the full history. I can't go in here and just teach Edgar Allan Poe and not the Harlem Renaissance. They got to get all of that. They have to get all of that. And that
just curse at the patient. Let's grab a question from the caller. All of that.
Sure.
7244, welcome to Black Earth America. You're on the line.
Peace, brother. Peace, family. Peace everyone.
Peace.
This is Equine. I'm calling from South Carolina. And this is a very interesting discussion. And one where a lot of our people, and just to be honest, I'm going to give, this is my opinion, all right? This is where my observation has led me. Our participation in the system is, we shouldn't be surprised that the same system that worked so hard to enslave us is actually still running like a finely tuned machine that it was created to run as. You understand? I think we shouldn't be surprised that we are still in today's atmosphere, regardless of how many slaves or how many slaves we don't have or how many chains have been actually cut. We still have those psychological chains around our minds, even when you hear the music. Talking about, out of all any music that I've ever heard in my life, this is the most degenerative, the most degrading music, the most offending, offensive music that I've ever heard in my life. This is a reality. And the very policy, the very political system, is a one, regardless if you red, white, or blue, whatever your color is, it is a one that is either supporting or sustained by the current dynamics in which this infrastructure is upheld. Even more so when you look at the LGBTQ. You understand? They are throwing pedophiles in there, and don't you know they're trying to get just due for pedophiles more so than they are for the black family. That's just the reality. So when we are, when this is known, and we are attempting to engage in these organizations, in these functions, it's no wonder that the very people that go in looking like us, and sometimes may even share our same sentiments and have similar intents, but they wind up being just a dancer for a check right? This is what we find. We even see that when we're looking at a lot of guys in sports. There are very few people in sports that were even speaking up about the social, racial injustices here in America. Because a lot, and those are the millionaires. Those are the well-to-do Negroes in America, right? Those are the ones with Lamborghinis. And these Negroes are still walking around like, oh, let me not say nothing because I don't want to mess up my check. So what are you thinking about these guys that are getting paid less money to run a city council or to be on a state board or senator or whatever it is? Now their interests are going to the place where the money is. And because us as black folk, we don't centralize our dollar. And when we do, it's on some very frivolous and silly stuff. You understand? Mm-hmm. So therefore, we don't have anybody that's behind. What we're going to need to do is start working on grooming what we feel like should be the candidate. You understand? We have to work on, this is what we spend a lot of our time in church.
That
I'm not,
the Tea Party
I'm not
did.
A Christian.
That what the Tea Party uh-huh. did. That what the Tea Party did.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
What they
right.
did.
Right,
mm-hmm.
right, right.
They got their local and got themselves a president. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay, thank you
right.
for your
and,
let's give our
okay, yes, sir. Yes, sir, absolutely.
Let's give our guests a chance to
okay.
engage in your comment. Go ahead, Ms. Samuel.
All right.
Mm-hmm. No, everything you touched on, number one, thank you for calling in and listening and sharing your sentiment.
Thank you
all. All of that. It is 100% true. And, you know, when I talk about coalitions and when I say putting money, this is no this is a well-known fact, right? Blacks spent $41 million in the 2020 presidential election. $41 million. And they put it behind Bernie Sanders. But when we look at track record and we go toe-to-toe with numbers to think about, number one, who's impactful, 357 pieces of legislation introduced by Sanders. 190 were considered a nominee. 12 were considered by the floor. 1 failed in 1 chamber. 6 passed in 1 chamber. 3 passed in both chambers to the president became law. One is veterans compensation. The other one is the United States Postal Service. And then one is the Thaddeus Stevens Post Office. That's what we put money behind. And you just said it. And then failing to realize, wait a minute, how many of us were under lockdown orders and mask guidelines? No one thinks about putting representation and impacts to day-to-day life. Your councilman and your governor, they're going to make more immediate decisions on how you educate your children, how your taxpayer dollars are spent, even your economic development and your quality of life in your local neighborhood down to your sidewalk. But we don't think about that. We don't think about even the commissions. And you brought up a very interesting point. We don't pay most state board of education. I think across the country there's only 4 school boards. Last time I ran data, that was 2019, 2020, that are still being compensated, right? Because there's like this stigma that education, you're supposed to be a martyr. You shouldn't get paid for your expertise in imparting knowledge on the future generation of everybody. Doctors, lawyers, the whole gamut. So that's an issue. And then we still have, too, this whole thing of like, well, it's just local. Like, we have, I would say, 92% of the professionals that come to the Urban Leaders Fellowship, they all rank D.C. as the top city that they want to impact local and state policy on because D.C. is like the sign of power. And we have to talk them down and say, we don't touch federal. And we're an agnostic organization, which means we don't look at Democrat and Republican. We look at people's tangibles, and we educate folks to look at the tangibles. What are they actually doing? What are they actually putting forth? And you would be surprised how many individuals to what you just said are like, what? They shouldn't get paid? No, the governor should. But failing to realize the day-to-day. Failing to realize the day-to-day, and it hurts us. Some of us are coming out of worlds of hurt. When I think about Detroit and I think about where so many of our brothers and sisters are, I mean, on every end, housing, We hadn't even got into housing.
Speak of housing.
Yes.
I got a question about housing. In terms of affordable housing, what type of policy are needed to address this issue in our communities? Because affordable housing is a very, very large issue in Black America.
Yes. Number one is we got to break down gentrification. And when I say break down gentrification, I'm talking about the negative aspect and I'm talking about the positive aspect. We also, as collective in our neighborhood, and many of us can probably think back to our grandparents, right, and our great-great-grandparents. Folks just didn't move in a neighborhood and you didn't know about them. We have got to get back to those roots and understanding that when people come into our neighborhood, we need to know what their purpose is for being there. We need to know what they are bringing. And a lot of times in the Black community, policy, when it comes to housing, it happens to us rather than working on. And so we get all these major high-rise condos. We get booted out, and then our elderly, they are being bought off, right? Or
right.
There might be a grandchild for whatever reason. Somebody's got to pay the property taxes. So guess what? You got Johnson and Danley or Delaney. They come in with a whopping check of $1.5 million. They're like, oh, you know, we'll take the property taxes for that because we're going to build it right on up. We have to fine-tune and do that research of who's coming in. And we've also got to realize, too, you know, we already knew back in the day that you couldn't vote without no property. But yet, we're getting away from that. And there's also, too, the flip side of the gentrification who's coming in as well as occupying our neighborhood is that collective power, that collective impact. As many individuals as I read every single day on LinkedIn, y'all probably see it, too. Brothers and sisters killing it. Like, I get excited. And then I start thinking about, well, how does this translate to day-to-day for, like, the hundreds of thousands of people in that area? How does that translate to representation and policy? What does this mean for the people who actually live there? Is that people have to make housing a priority in the Black community, and we also have to realize, too, that when it comes to income, some of us are still, even as we're out educating, are out enrolling our counterparts, we're still
I have a question. Sorry for cutting you off, but the things that you're saying, you know, I want to ask this question before I lose it. Hey, I did have this question on my original list of questions. You're running for office, right? What
right.
will be your major agenda? I talk about on the local level or state level. Let's say you're running for a state senator or congresswoman or mayor. What would be your agenda when it comes to the Black community? And if and when you're elected, how would you change some of the current policies that's going on?
That's a good question, and I've been thinking about it.
You sound like
Number
it.
One.
Hold on, Ms. Samuel. There's a reason why I asked that question. It just didn't drop out of the sky. I'm just going off the things you're saying, the issue addressed, and how you're stating. I said, this woman's about to run for some office. Go ahead.
Sure. There's several, but I'm going to bucket housing me in one.
And after you finish, we're going to have Michonne ask another question, and probably that question probably could take us into tomorrow. Go ahead, Ms. Go ahead, Ms. Samuel.
Sure. The first one is housing. Number one, as I just said before, we got people homeless out on the street or damn near close. And that is an issue. The other issue is if we look around in several of our major cities, it's very hard now to find in all black neighborhoods. You have Chinatown, Houston. We're known for having one of the largest Chinatowns in America, et cetera. So that collective community, we have it in spaces. We call it the nickel, third, and fourth, and fifth ward. But what happens is that outside of these small little insulated areas, we don't have that sense of community because people have moved on and moved out. They have their reasons. Oh, the school is better or this is better, which education's number three on my list. I'm about to get to it in about 42 seconds. But housing will be first. Number one, ensuring that housing matches people's income. And when I say matching their income, not based on when I fill out the credit report and I see the numbers back and be like, oh, they can't afford this.
David Dickens tried to do that back in the late 80s. He tried to do that. He tried to pass a bill in New York City, you know, on what you're saying. And they tore him up, too.
Yes, absolutely. Because there's this misconception, even with credit. And then even when we think about different generations of individuals, retirees, and now we're in a space where folks are caring for their parents or their grandparents or what's left of our octarians and our old head matriarchs and patriarchs, we have to understand that their sense to the dollar isn't going to stretch like their other counterparts. We also have to realize, too, we've got to build communities up with us. Everyone knows at least five people who have an e-store. If they don't have an e-store, they're selling something through a cash app. There is collective power in that. If we can start building in addition to having that income and making sure that businesses are mobilized the way that Nipsey Hussle has done it, and in different spaces across the country, that's a very powerful thing. So that's twofold where I would start. I would go really, really in-depth, but I'm going to keep it at two. Second is economic development. Again, a lot of us are in areas, whether it is retail, even when we're in salary roles, we are still not earning what it is that we deserve. And, of course, I can deviate from that and say, all right, we also need to be businessmen, too, and create our own businesses as we're able to invest and save in property.
So why are some governments scared of black folks creating their own businesses and wealth? Mm-hmm. I mean, like Ice Cube came out with a agenda, and nobody did want to meet with him. Why are officials, local, state, and federal, afraid of black folks having the ideology of wanting to create their own businesses so they can have their own wealth? Why is that such a scary issue? And why are people that come up with that ideology scorned?
Well, they're not going to be able to make any money off of us. Think about it. Think about when our sisters go and purchase bonnets. And this is something I was doing a little research around, with all the stigma that's come out with the Bonnets Unite and everything that Monique has said. It's like, who owns bonnet companies? Just out of curiosity. If we have sisters in every single area in healthcare, in essence, did a expose a couple of months on like 20 women that are leading hair care line products, beautiful thing to see. If we had that in every single industry, it would dismantle their system. But see, you can't get rich off people that have their own.
Yeah.
You can't.
Look at the Hasidic Jews and look at the Asians. And now the Middle Eastern.
Exactly. And not only that, we are the workhorses and the work mules of society, especially our black women. It's unfortunate. I have gone through this myself of people using my intellectual capital and profiteering and puppeteering off of my back. And the last school district that I was in, I was a founding dean. We helped build a school for black and brown children, right? When my name came up for promotion, I didn't get it. It was given to my white counterpart and a whole other campus that really hadn't seen the fragility of our kids in North Houston. That's fine. People cannot, they can argue, they can say whatever. I have no hate against this person. She and I worked very closely on my way out to this role. But think about all of those years of, like, building a school, building trust, getting to know families. I live 10 minutes away. My kids are in the neighborhood.
Doing in the all-black school, founded by blacks, developed by blacks and whatnot. What's the white teacher doing in there anyway?
Well,
I don't mean to sound prejudiced or anything, but did we say earlier that we need to hire more black teachers so black children can look at individuals that look like us?
Absolutely.
Hey, Sean, I know you've got a question burning. Go ahead.
Of course I do. Okay, to fuel a growing demand for profitable prison labor, black people are disproportionately incarcerated and given longer sentences than any other race, benefiting several corporations. How can this be stopped?
Yeah, answer that, future candidate. How can you address the – I was going to ask that later, but we spent so much time on Michonne question educational policy. Yeah, yes, how would you answer? Well, let me ask you this. Do you think there are problems with the criminal justice system and the black community?
Absolutely.
How would you address that? How would you, what would be your policy? How would you address that as a candidate or elected official?
Sure. I think the first thing to look at is resources. And a lot of times we spend resources on locking people up and putting them in a box. There's about 63 million people that have some form of blemish on their record. It could be a small warrant. It could be all the way up to a federal warrant. And that blocks them not only from housing and from education, it blocks them from really being able to get on their feet. And so the first thing I would do with several of my counterparts that are also working on this issue, whether it's Houston or in some of our urban cities, is set resources up for individuals who are coming out of these situations so they are not left on the street and kind of left to go back to making some choices to survive. So that's one part, that's the aftermath. On the other hand, we've got individuals being sentenced and being given bogus sentences on marijuana possession, folks getting up to 20 years. And that has to stop because in the reality of it, we've got rapists, and it's not to compare sin against sin or crime against crime. We have individuals who are literally ripping up the safety of where we live, but to get a slap on the wrist. So we've got to look at, too, in our policies, how are we approaching rehabilitation, in addition to rehabilitation, implementation, preparing law enforcement, getting a tighter reins on the union. I think we can all agree and attest to there is a sentiment for defunding and divesting because there is this lack of trust in the systems that even if someone is doing something, that we assume and automatically use tactics and excessive force that shouldn't be. So all of those things I will work on down to the chief of police, down the neighborhood watch of like, okay, before we're going in to arrest someone or even make an assumption on what they're doing, there is a proper way to ensure that. there is a proper way. It doesn't have to end up in loss of life. So that's on one end. Then we have to look at sentencing on another end. And then we have to look at our brothers and sisters when they are coming out. How are they able to set themselves up for success, especially when there is family involved?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the family's doing time too. I also have a question about the criminal justice system, but more or less in the community. What would you do about violence / gangs in our black communities across America? I mean, what would be, let's say there was a mayor conference. They had those mayor, do they still have the mayor conferences? And the issue with most black cities or most black communities, especially low to middle income, is the violence and the gangs. What would be your policy to address that issue?
My policy to address the issue? This is outside
yeah,
of
violence in the community and gangs. Like in Baltimore, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to look for our black men. I'm going to look for our black men in these communities. Because we know that when we have the presence of a black man, I said the presence of a black man, because we can go several different ways, father, all of that. Having their presence and also their level to relate and identify with men who are at that age, that depending upon what they are dealing with, they are looking for a family. They are looking for direction and protection and guidance. And so the way to combat that in terms of young men and women joining gangs is we've got to have the presence there, men and women, to be able to give our children a different way of life. There's another way that we can do it. And it doesn't have to result in violence. It doesn't have to result in you becoming a Blood or a Crip. And when we get down to the heart of it, if we were to pull some of them in from the East and West Coast, and as you said, in Baltimore, many of them will say.
A lot of them in Chicago, too, Gangsta Disciples, TDs in Chicago.
Yes. It's having that presence. So my first immediate policy is, I need to see who is in this community. I need to see what has been in place. And on top of that, we need to link arms together to protect and raise and build up our men and women. I can't throw
Miss Sanders, there are a lot of men, a lot of adults that are afraid of these teenagers or young adults. They're afraid. How can you encourage people to come out when they're afraid? What would you say? What would you do?
Do you want your community today or you want it burned down tomorrow? Either way, we can't live in fear and we can't just give things away. When we look 40, 50 years ago, people died for us even to have the conversation that we're having right now. And I think we've gotten very comfortable, Kenneth, in this day and age of being able to have these talk pieces, right? Social media platforms. And I'm for them. They're fine. They have a tool. But beyond that tool, what is your action? Do we sit scared and let gangs, Pilgrim, shoot everything up? What was it in Chicago a couple of weeks ago? 54 people shot, 9+ died. You're giving violence and destruction away. You're saying, no, it's okay to tear us up. I don't really care. I'm scared of you. When the reality of it is, if you give it over, you're not going to have a place to sleep. It's going to be total chaos. And so we have to get past that and realize
and or not only that, you're going to lose your community. and did justification for what they call lock up everybody, fill the jails and prisons again, okay, because that's how they keep their money coming, by filling up the beds. Now, we lock everybody up, we're going to make the community safe again, and we're going to take your community away and displace the families. Because you can't, you can't control or keep your community safe. So we're going to displace you somewhere else where it's going to be difficult to go to work, to travel to work, where it's going to be, and you're going to be new to the environment. It's not going, you're not going to have things so accessible to you. So that's what they do. Ms. Samuels, I appreciate the conversation. And I really enjoyed the discussion. I thank you for coming on Black Urban America. And I hope everything out there in Texas, you know, with the storm and everything, and the power outage improves.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate both of you just taking the time out and just having this discussion. I'm grateful. I revel in it. I want more of us in the Black community to, like, spend some time on this, like, really pull it apart. And, you know, I hear more and more in terms of, like, reparations and representation. That's great. What does that representation do for the agenda? Like, really putting pen to paper, pulling things apart. And I encourage folks, if you got an hour in your day, equate that over a period of time. And as people are elected at the city and local level, watch them, follow them, hold them accountable to their word, because they are representing for you.
And
I just
don't
want more
always
of us
listen to the lip service, do the research.
Absolutely. Do the research, check the stats, check the facts, look at who their alliances are, because I'm telling you, you would be surprised how many folks are being funded by people who have an opposite agenda. And we don't know it until they get elected and we start checking fundraising records and we see $218 million going to this party for this agenda that's killing us. And so we're making progress. I celebrate it. It's a lot more work for us to do. And we can't just vote for people because they look like us. They've got to come with some tangible.
Yes. Thank you so much, Ms. Sam. Ms. Sean, what's going on for tomorrow night?
I am going to be discussing the Olympics.
The Olympics? Really?
And the situations, people have been positive for marijuana, et cetera.
Yeah. Okay, great. All right, folks, that's it for the week. That's it for
the week. Thank you.
That's it for the week, folks. I'm glad for everybody tuning in and the comments. As always, I am because we are. We are because I am. See you.
Not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to